The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 362, Laws and Orders at Winter Quarters, by Edward L. Kemble, with comments by Lee Wortham.
Well, I'll begin the session. My name is Kirsten Wald, and I'm here to introduce Ed Kemble, who's going to be speaking to us. And I loved his title, Laws and Orders at Winter Quarters. So if you're wondering where you are, that's what you've come to hear about. Ed gave me a really great introduction, so I'm going to take from his introduction and my introduction of him. Ed Kemble is no longer teaching law at BYU. He has been released as bishop. His seven children are independent and no longer need him. The books and articles on the law that he wrote gather dust. Nearly all the books he has written of biography and church history are out of print. The weeds flourish as soon as he turns his back on the garden, which I can completely relate to myself. The book he is writing about the administration of Church President Spencer W. Kemble seems to go on forever, and his hair is rapidly disappearing. But his wife, Bea, still loves him. So with that, I will turn the time over to Ed Kemble.
So do all of his in-laws.
Thank you very much, Kirsten. In the winter of 1846, the Mormons began streaming out of Nauvoo and crossing the Mississippi River on the ice. And they struggled across Iowa's interminable mud, hoping that an advance company would be able to establish a base in the West that summer. They were headed for the Great Basin, and they wished to get an advance company there to plant crops so that they could get there in 1846. However, the difficulties of travel and the call to service of 500 men in the Mormon battalion that summer made it clear that the move further west would have to wait until 1847. So they had to find a place to settle down for the winter to prepare for the stream of refugees coming behind them as well. They had to catch up. So in 1846, at the Missouri River, the Mormons established 80-odd small clusters on the Iowa side of the Missouri River, averaging maybe 100 people in each of those little clusters, while on the west side, they established one large settlement that they named Winter Quarters. Two large companies under Brigham Young and Heber C. Kemble decided on September the 20th, 1846, to move from their first tentative camp to a site on the Missouri River, located just across the river from Iowa Territory on Omaha Indian lands. They were there by agreement with the Omaha tribe, and they were outside of any organized territory of the United States. The Mormons surveyed the city, and on September the 23rd, they began to move on to the land. It was quickly developed. Winter quarters had a compact configuration, 22 blocks, basically a bishop for each block. The history of winter quarters is therefore rather precisely limited in space. It's a compact village of about 700 homes on surveyed blocks and lots, mostly small cabins, but some tents and dugouts in the hillside. It's limited in duration. They agreed with the Indians to be off the land within 2 years. Actually, winter quarters lasted about a year and a half from the time they first moved onto that plot of land until the time that they had pretty much vacated it in the spring of 48. It's limited in size. Winter quarters had a census taken just a few months after it began, and there were short of 4,000 people, which was the basic size of winter quarters throughout its life. It was limited in the makeup because it was nearly all Mormons. There were some non-Mormons who were members of Mormon family households, but it was almost exclusively Mormons who were refugees from Nauvoo. Some others had joined them from other places, knowing that they were on their way west to a promised land. It's also limited in the constraints that were upon them. They were completely isolated, almost completely isolated from non-Mormons. They were within reach of Missouri settlements and some Iowa towns, but basically they were across the river where there was no organized government of the United States. There was an Indian agent responsible for the Omaha Indians, and that's really the only government representation that at this time was west of the Missouri River in that part of the country. So with the lack of constraints upon them from external sources, then it was really possible for them to think of what is Mormon law. What kind of a system shall we establish here? The thing I want to talk about is what the law was in winter quarters. And let me first state some conclusions, and then I'll offer some anecdotes that tend to illustrate the points. In the first place, in winter quarters, there was almost no distinction between the theocratic, ecclesiastical side and the civil government side. The two things were intertwined in such a way that there was no significant difference between them. There was nobody outside to tell them what they had to do, and what they did was free then from any real government control. The basic organization that they adopted was established by the Quorum of the Twelve. They called the 12-man High Council for winter quarters. They also named them Municipal Council, so that they served simultaneously a church function and a governmental function. And they did not, as far as I can tell, make any distinction between the two. They were simply the government of winter quarters. They had legislative, judicial, and executive functions. They decided on some ordinances. They sat as a court, both a primary trial court and as an appellate court. And they instructed the police and other few government officials, like the sexton for the cemetery and the ferryman to transport across the river, as to what they should do. Now, the mere fact that the 12 men on the High Council and City Council were nominally in charge didn't take away from the fact that the Quorum of the 12 was really in charge if they wished to exercise any authority. And since in winter quarters there were almost always a fair number of the 12 who were there, Brigham Young was there, for example, until he went west in the summer of spring of 47, there was always somebody looking over their shoulder. And at the next lower level, there were bishops. 22 bishops were assigned for the 22 blocks of the city, which is, interestingly enough, was set out in a plat. And to think of a city that short in duration being configured by surveyors, set out there with the log cabins and tents, with the instructions as to how many outhouses and where they had to be located, and four wells to the block, and so on, is interesting, very highly organized. But the bishops had also similar sweep of functions. They were judges, they tried cases, they were the social service arm of the city, they looked after the poor primarily, they were responsible for organizing church services and encouraging education. They served a little bit as justices of the peace would in our society. This was no democracy. But the people did, of course, have a veto power, as they were presented the names of the high councilors, just as they were on occasion the Quorum of the Twelve, to accept or reject. They didn't reject, but then that was because they were committed to this as the kingdom of God. But a substantial number of people did leave, so that if they weren't satisfied with the government, they just simply left. Those who stayed in winter quarters were those who were prepared to stick with it. They were ready to spring as a springboard from winter quarters to leave and go west. The next agency, and in some ways the most interesting to me, is the police force of winter quarters. Their primary task was to protect them against Indians. The Indians were thieves and killed a lot of oxen and stole a lot of horses over the period there. And they rationalized it on the grounds that these were, after all, interlopers on their land. The Mormons responded, "But we're here by agreement. You allowed us to stay here, and so you have no right to take our property." But the Mormons paid a certain amount of compensation to the Indians, and indeed occasionally gave them livestock. But protecting against Indian depredations was the primary objective of the police. There was one death by Indian attack in the area during the time they were there, but otherwise there were not any Indian attacks on the settlement. The police had also to enforce the law within the town, and they had the same kinds of issues that you would expect in any town. But the level of criminality, it seems to me, was quite low. I have no statistical figures to offer, but my impression is that for a frontier town, it was remarkably law-abiding, a town of 4,000 people crowded together in a temporary location, substantial poverty, inadequate food, a lot of opportunity to be angry and upset and act out. Another conclusion that I get from reading this in pioneer journals is that their lives were very physical, not in the way I'm used to, sitting at my desk. They were walking miles was nothing they thought about as of any consequence. There was death all around them, especially the first winter in winter quarters because of the scurvy and other diseases that were communicable. The estimate is that up to 600 people died, though some figures would put it at more like 400 who died in winter quarters during that time. But at any rate, nobody was surprised when an infant passed away or a disease took away an adult. So life and death was not as dramatic as it is in our lives. I think for individuals it was as poignant in the individual loss, but death was all around them and had been because of the living conditions in which they had lived before. Another conclusion that I derived from reading is that their lives were very volatile, their relationships. They were quick to anger, quick to forgive. Public confession of wrongdoing was the norm, and that brought almost certain reconciliation. Living conditions were highly uncertain. People were unsure sometimes whether they would have enough to eat, when illness might take away their lives, and what plans there were to move a whole people 1,000 miles to the west. They just didn't have short-run expectations that were very settled, though they were optimistic, and they had long-run expectations that they would survive, be in the west, and establish there the kingdom of God. They were optimistic people, and now, let me read you an anecdote from Hosea Stout's journal. He was the chief of police. I'll interpolate a little bit in his so that you know what's happening. This morning, Counselor Phineas Richards, who was a member of the High Council and also of the City Council, came to me and wanted Henry Boley's ox arrested for damages done in Richards' garden. I sent officers Meeks and Gardner, who took the ox. The ox was brought to the stray pen. They had a stray pen where trespassing animals were kept until the owner paid a penalty. But Boley and his son attempted to rescue the ox by violence, which caused quite an uproar in the town. When they menaced the officers, Gardner and Meeks drew a pistol and told them to stand back, and if they had objections to the seizure of the ox, to go with their complaint to the council that served to oversee the police. The Boleys were stopped by the pistol, but young Boley swore he would shoot them for it. A charge was laid against young Boley before Bishop Calkins for threatening to shoot the officers. We went to arrest him, but found he'd gone to the prairie for hay. We overtook him about 4 miles away. He refused to come back till night at first, but at last did come. The bishop put off the trial till 7 p.m. when the council would meet as a court, and released Boley until that time while we prepared for trial. At 7 o'clock, we went to the trial, and after a full investigation that lasted until about 11, the charge was sustained, and Boley was fined $5. He manifested a very bad spirit after the trial. $5 is about 5 days' pay in those days, roughly. Well, somebody who was unhappy with what had happened in winter quarters had really three choices. One, they could appeal to he'd had a trial at the council, so the only appeal was to the Quorum of the Twelve. Not very likely to succeed. He could pay the fine, or he could leave. Those were the three choices. As a temporary settlement in the wilderness, winter quarters lacked some of the things that Nauvoo had had. It didn't have a city charter. It didn't have elected officials. It didn't have a traditional court system. There were no substantial number of non-Mormons that had to be taken into account. One thing that they did have, like Nauvoo, was the police force. Indeed, it was largely the same people. And Hosea Stout had been the chief of police in Nauvoo, and most of the 20-odd policemen that were designated in winter quarters had also served under him in Nauvoo. So they were an experienced bunch who stood guard at night, usually in two shifts, 5 hours and 5 hours in the night, of several men at each shift. The Quorum of the Twelve, of course, under the leadership of Brigham Young, was there. Indeed, when the council met and they were in town, they met with the council. And my guess is that their vote may have counted more than one each. And when Brigham voted, that may have counted more than 12. There was no stake president, you see, in the town, so it was, in a sense, the high council and the bishops that were acting. In the church level, there was no presidency, and so the Quorum of the 12 was the organizational body that governed. So you don't have a separate executive either in the town or in the church at this time. At one point, there was a question as to what constitutes a quorum of the city council. If you have less than 7, do you have a quorum? And Willard Richards said yes. Interesting, his view, if there's only one member of the high council present, he has a right to try cases, to cut people off, to make whiskey laws. That is, he could decide between litigants, he could act for the church in excommunicating, and he could enact ordinances for the community and enforce them. The council met every Sunday and often during the week to hear cases and to make other kinds of decisions. The bishops, as I said, conducted trials. I gather that they were more like justices of the peace. I don't have any formal knowledge of what their jurisdictional limits were, if at all, but as a practical matter, they tended to pass on to the council the more serious cases that came up. The bishops scheduled the trial in the one I just read you about. He decided to release the prisoner. He also apparently served as a prosecutor in the evening because he gave a speech to the council, which Hosea Stout said was a long and very interesting speech from the bishop, after which the council found Bowley guilty. The bishops had other civic responsibilities, two of which are interesting in this light. One was they controlled the dancing and they controlled the liquor. On the religious side, bishops also cared for the poor, and they held church services, encouraged schooling, and they had to certify people as prepared to go west before they were allowed to join any of the pioneer companies. That really was two parts. One is that he had to certify that they had adequate supplies. They had enough teams, wagons, food supplies to make it all the way to Utah and be prepared to go through the winter after they arrived without any new crops. And the second is he had to certify that they had been helpful in maintaining the community fields. They had individual garden plots, but they also had large community fields that were fenced and plowed and harvested by people as a group. And so if they hadn't done their share, the bishop would not certify. And that didn't mean they couldn't go west. It just meant that they couldn't be part of an organized church company that was on its way west. There was also a 70s. There were a number of 70s forums. They were organized in the winter quarters, and they held hearings. I call them courts. They seemed, though, not to have been so much concerned with the secular side as with people's religious standing. They didn't impose fines, apparently. At least there's no mention of it. Apparently they did feel they could cut people off the church, however. They were having hearings on improper conduct by their quorum members. For example, Hosea Stout himself, the chief of police, was hailed before the 70 and charged with assault, profanity, and other unchristian-like conduct. Well, when you talk about profanity and unchristian-like conduct, you're really talking more of the language of church court than you are secular court. The police were a rough bunch. They drank a lot. They were sometimes overbearing. They were heartily disliked by people who didn't like to be ordered around by the police. But they were remarkably loyal to the church leaders. They were a rough crowd who saw their job as getting done what the presidency, or excuse me, the 12 wanted them to do. Sometimes they did things that were highly irregular, and then they would report those to the quorum of the 12 and get after-the-fact approval. For example, just before winter quarters was established, while they were still in the camp a few miles away, there was an occasion where, on private instructions from Brigham Young, the marshal and several of the police whipped three young men who were believed involved in immoral conduct with two young women. Now, the beating was severe enough to draw blood from one of them. Two of them had 18 lashes to the back and one 30 lashes to the back. At the next public meeting, Brigham Young said, in effect, they deserved it. He said also that he didn't know about it in advance, which I think is untrue. At least Hosea Stout says that he got permission in advance. The police also sometimes whipped kids who were making too much noise in the nighttime. When they found herders who were careless about allowing cattle to be where they weren't supposed to be, they would whip them. So a little bit of physical beating was one of the things that they felt free to do without official authorization, but with a kind of a tacit understanding that do what you need to do, boys, to keep this place orderly and clean. There were other miscellaneous activities. For example, they searched a non-member, a young man named Long, because they had a suspicion he was a spy for the government, there to get some dirt on the Mormons. And he eloped with a Mormon girl and went off to Fort Kearney, which is south, not the present Fort Kearney, but a different Fort Kearney that was south by Nebraska City. And then he came back a month or so later and was with four Army officers looking for a deserter. And while he happened to be in town, the police nabbed him, arrested him, made him believe they were going to kill him, kept him in the cold for hours, and then finally let him go, saying, you thought you could fool us, make fun of us, as he apparently had been bragging that he ran away with this Mormon girl and lived to tell the tale. So they were doing things that we'd think of as vigilante kinds of action sometimes, but they had the confidence, in spite of all that, and maybe even because of that, in part by the confidence of the church leaders.
Is Porter Rockwell one of the police officers?
No, not here then. No. Let me talk a little bit about the law that was to apply in winter quarters. Asserting that they were essentially free to apply whatever law they thought was appropriate because the government wasn't about to hinder their activities. There was a sense of common law. Now, I don't mean necessarily inherited directly like other courts did the common law of England, but the same sense that is underlying the common law tradition, that there are some things people just know are forbidden by being part of a society. You just know, without it being spelled out in the statutes, that murder and rape and arson and theft are simply unacceptable conduct. And so even if there is no rule written down, the courts in England and the Mormon courts in winter quarters felt completely free to impose sanctions on people who were acting in ways that everybody would know were intolerable. There was then a kind of an overlay on that. This was a refugee society. They'd been driven from their homes most recently, just a few months before from Nauvoo, but in succession from Kirtland, some of them, and from Missouri, others. And so they felt themselves imposed upon. There's got to be a stronger word than that. But they demanded loyalty from their own members. And so if there were excessive criticisms from within, they thought of that as a punishable offense. Edwin D. Woolley, my great-grandfather, who was a merchant, and on one occasion he was accused of sedition, seditious speech. He apparently had criticized, in what terms I don't know, the leadership of the church, and so they held a court, convicted him of that, and fined him $100. As I say, at a dollar a day, that's by 20 times the largest fine that was imposed during the year there that I know of. Then, interesting thing, Brigham Young said, but I vote that we cancel the fine. And then they sat around talking about the importance of unity and how sedition like this was truly a crime against the community, but it was also to be forgiven if people were sufficiently repentant. And Edwin was sufficiently repentant, and so he didn't pay the $100, but everybody got an object lesson by the use of the court trial against him. There were some religious principles that are unarticulated, and I don't know how far they would have extended, but for example, the police prevented the establishment of a gambling table, a gaming table. There's no scripture that I know of against gaming, and yet it was against the policy, unarticulated policy, of the community. There were city ordinances that were formally acted by the council as the legislature for the town, about half a dozen of them that I know of. One was Indians caught in theft should be beaten and not killed. That was a formal legislation, and indeed the Omaha chief agreed that that's what ought to be done, because he said, we don't countenance their stealing from you, so if you catch them, don't kill them, beat them. And anybody who killed an Indian was supposed to be turned over to the Indians for punishment, which they assumed would be capital punishment, but no occasions of that arose during the year. People were not to trade with the Indians, and if they did, they would pay a penalty and lose the property that they had obtained by trade. Stray animals would be impounded. You know, they had thousands of animals, most of them out in herding areas away from town, but this was a horse and wagon age, and so there were a great many animals in there. And stray animals were impounded, put in a stray pen, and people had to pay a dollar per horse or cow, 25 cents for a sheep running loose. And they were especially concerned when these animals got into the community fields, where people didn't feel an individual responsibility and they were eating up the food that the settlers need. Dances could be held only with the permission of the bishop, who had to be personally present. And liquor could be sold in winter quarters only by the bishops. And they were not to sell to anybody who couldn't afford it. So that if somebody was poor, they were not to be buying liquor. And the dealers who already had a stock of whiskey before the ordinance was passed were entitled to be paid for the whiskey. They couldn't keep it. It went to the bishops, but they would be paid for it. Later on, if somebody smuggled whiskey into town to sell it, it was confiscated and they were not paid. But the bishops used what profit they made off the whiskey to support the poor. Then there was another source of law that is what they called the law of God. The law of God is a little bit amorphous, but it appears to have been principles taught in the Council of 50 in what's called the Kingdom of God. The laws that are mentioned are very severe, and the exact scope of them we don't know. I don't know. Capital punishment for murder, capital punishment for adultery. There's reference to capital punishment for theft, though I have trouble seeing that as seriously intended, but perhaps. In any event, this was a sense that when the theocratic government of God was established, and they saw that as in the near future, that when they got to Utah, the Great Basin, that they would establish a kingdom of God there where they would live by a higher law, a more demanding, a stricter law, where murder and adultery would, in fact, be the basis for capital punishment. But while we're in winter quarters, it's almost always if and when. If you keep doing this, we will invoke the law of God upon you. Or when we get out west, then the law of God will demand more of you than you are presently giving. I can read you passages that are reflective of that. For example, there was a man on the trail before they got to winter quarters who was guilty of adultery. A letter from Samuel Richards says, I understand that one Darby has left the camp being guilty of adultery as a penalty for which he had either to lose his head or his manhood as the only means of salvation for him. I have not heard what is to be done with the woman. I'd like to know if death is imposed. Well, see, there was in the consciousness of the people, rather widely, a notion that these kinds of crimes were significant enough that in a theocratic society, a church-governed society, they deserved serious punishment. In fact, Derby was not executed. He left for a time, then asked Brigham Young for permission to return to the saints, and Brigham said, go back to your family and be a good father and husband. And so he rejoined the saints for a number of years and then apparently left activity in the church. But at any rate, there's this talk about very high standards, very harsh standards, that were not imposed in individual situations that might have called for it. The three boys that were beaten, for example, for immoral conduct, adultery, Hosea Stout says, that they, when they took the first fellow out into the woods, he begged for his life. He was afraid they were going to kill him. He said, no, we're not going to kill you. And then he said, he begged not to be castrated. And Stout said, well, no, we're only going to whip you. And so then, after they beat him, we taught him the principles of the law and the just punishment for such crimes and what he needed to expect if ever we had to visit him again. Now, since we had declared unto him the law of God. Later on in Utah, Brigham Young makes an explanation that I think helps us understand more what's at stake. Well, I may have to paraphrase it for you, but he said basically, those who know the law are expected to live by the law. There are a great many people who are in ignorance, even though they're members of the church and have been taught. But if someone like me did the things that they do, then upon me, would come the judgment of God. In other words, capital punishment would be justified for someone who had made covenants in the temple, as Brigham Young had and many others had, to abide by those basic principles of chastity. So, in spite of the talk about the law of God, there is very little indication that it was, in fact, in force in any sense. Indeed, one time they even said that the council decided to have the law of God put in force. But as far as I can tell, nothing different happened. There are no reports of people missing. There is one suggestive case, however, a fellow named James Herring, who threatened Wilford Woodruff and the other brethren, was excommunicated. He left town, and over a year later, he came back and someone killed him. They also said, that with respect to Herring, I shouldn't skip that, the law of God should be administered in righteousness with respect to Herring. So it is possible that that might be a case where the so-called law of God was in fact imposed in winter quarters, but that's a matter of speculation. William Hickman, who was one of the rough characters who wrote an expose after the fact, said that he had killed Herring for the benefit of Brigham Young. Whether that was true or not, he's not a highly reliable witness. Some other illustrations. J.T. Packer was charged with stealing some pistols. Some people urged that he be cut off from the church. Hosea Stout said, give him another chance, but if he offends again, we'll cut him off behind the ears, according to the law of God. So it was mostly if and when. The language, I think, was intimidating, and it was intended to be intimidating. It was pretty clearly mostly rhetoric. It was to make people, one, afraid to stay unless they were willing to abide by the standards, and secondly, it was intended to say that in the future, when the time comes, we will have a different society, a society that abides by a very high standard. Okay, here's the passage I was looking for. The law is very strict. This is Brigham Young in 1856. In this congregation there are men and women who, with uplifted hands to heaven, before the Father, the Son, and all the holy angels, made solemn covenants that they would never do thus and so. But some still commit adultery. Do we enforce upon them the strict penalty of the law? Not yet. I hope their conduct arises from their ignorance. But let me transgress my covenant, and the case would be different. Some of the specific cases or areas of law enforcement. Violence, the level was low. One thing that's interesting is that threats and attempts didn't seem to count much. That's an interesting factor in terms of perception. If somebody shoots at you and misses, it's to be shrugged off. We have a much higher standard of punishing people for attempts and conspiracies and plots than they had in those days. Threatening was, of course, Joseph Herring, the one who ultimately died, was guilty of threatening, and that may have been his main problem. Nathaniel Thomas Brown threatened the lives of the 12, but no action was taken that I can tell. As a matter of fact, he joined the Pioneer Company going west. Cutler stood trial for whipping a boy. Hosea Stout scuffled with Isaac Hill, accusing him of being disloyal, and he choked him, said he would have killed him until he was pulled off by another man. Stout was tried for excessive use of force, but the trial ended when Brigham Young said, "Both you men, stop it." So that's what happened. The punishment wasn't always as severe as the law of God might have dictated. The very first case that the council had involved a domestic dispute. Archibald Beers threw his wife out of the tent into the rain. Said he abused his children, which may have meant that he beat them, I don't know. He may have beat his wife as well, but at any rate, interesting thing, the council, instead of punishing him, simply treated it as a divorce action and decreed how they would divide up the family property. But a month later, Hosea Stout, they were living together happily again, as though nothing had ever happened. Most of the violence that occurred in winter quarters grew out of the stray pen. People were not about to have their animals hauled off, put in the stray pen, and have to pay to get them back. You remember the Boley's ox? That was an illustration of the problem. Mr. Blazard was fined $5, not just for the trespass by his ox, but for what they called rebelliousness in fighting to keep the ox from being taken to the pound. John D. Lee got in a fight about his straying ox, and the council ordered him to apologize. He apologized, but they said that wasn't good enough. There was not a freely given apology. It was very grudging. And they asked for a sincere apology. But he was unable to give a sincere apology. And so they adjourned it until Brigham Young came back and sort of turned it over to Brigham. And Brigham was pretty harsh. In effect, he divorced Lee from his family and said that as a consequence of this misconduct, his wives and children, meaning really adopted adults more than little children, were free to leave him. They had covenanted to stay with him. They were freed now by a decree of Brigham Young. Another fight. I won't bother you with each one of them, but except the one of Daniel Russell. He was a member of the High Council. And Daniel Russell got in a fight and lied, and this was all about his stray animals again. He also apologized finally, but that was also unacceptable. He couldn't apparently apologize properly, so one of the high counselors, Brother Harris, got permission to confess on his behalf. So he confessed fully and humbly, and then Russell said, "That's what I meant to say." Theft. There was theft by the Indians. There was some theft within the community. One of the thieves was named Rodney Badger, who stole a horse from a Missourian. Because it was from an, quote, innocent Missourian, they made him take the horse back. Which the choice of the word innocent suggests that they thought of the Missourians who had driven them out, who had been part of the mobs, had no complaint at losing a horse. The Mormons had lost much more than a horse in Missouri. But since this was an innocent Missourian, they sent Badger back with the horse to make amends to the person from whom he had taken it. There was a horse thief who got 39 strokes on his bare back. Why 39? Because the Bible says it shouldn't be more than 40. And if you want to be sure you don't go more than 40, then you stop when short of 40. So that's been a traditional number for beatings to avoid the Old Testament's commandment not to impose more than 40 lashes. And also, there was a practice among them of requiring fourfold return for thefts. It wasn't uniformly applied, but in a great many cases, fourfold return was called for. There's only one woman, aside from the sex offenses, that was involved, and that was a woman who was accused of stealing a silk skirt from one of Brigham Young's family members. Sexual immorality was another category in which a number of cases came up.
Oh, really?
Oh, dear. Okay.
We got to give Lisa a minute.
Russell was said to have done some unbecoming things with Sister Hart. W.W. Phelps was off on a mission to get a printing press and came back with three extra wives who had been married to him by Brother Jacobs, who was his missionary companion. He was excommunicated for having engaged in unauthorized plural marriages. This is the third time, incidentally, W.W. Phelps was excommunicated. He was a very resilient fellow, and 8 days later he was rebaptized, and the marriages that he had undertaken unauthorizedly were authorized at this point. But Brigham Young characterized his act as an act of adultery because the marriages were unauthorized and therefore the relationship was illicit. There were two men who were tried for living with women they weren't married to. One of them had volunteered the information, and because of his penitent attitude, he was promptly forgiven and sealed by Brigham Young. They were sealed. The one case that is most troubling, I guess, is one of a man who seduced two girls, said not over 12 years of age. He was excommunicated as well, though, as with so many others who showed repentant spirit, he was soon rebaptized as a member of the church. Fair amount of disorderly conduct, noise in the streets at night, critical language, firing of pistols on the Sabbath. The liquor, I've already mentioned, there were several times when liquor sales were found to be illegal and the police confiscated the supply. Dancing, several occasions when the dance was held without a bishop being present or without the right bishop being present. It wasn't good enough just to have a bishop there. You had to have the bishop of the ward in which the dance was held. Disputes over personal debts, disputes over property. One involved whether John D. Lee had given to Andrew Lytle's wife enough property in exchange for money that her husband had provided. Brigham Young testified on behalf of John D. Lee in the trial and said, I've never known, if basically John D. Lee keeps good books. And if he says that he gave the woman the property, he did. And so John D. Lee was, but Brigham went on and said, but if it were me, I'd forgive the debt. John D. Lee stands up and says, I forgive the debt. One case grew out of communal property interests that is sort of tangential to the story. James Emmett had a group, and Bishop Miller had a group. These were groups, sort of offshoots, that were off separate from the main body of the saints. And it was an agreement among that group that if they left, they would hold property in common, and if they left, they left everything behind them. And one man left the group, and when the group finally came to winter quarters, he says, I want my property back. And Brigham Young said that only God can require that kind of a covenant. And therefore, Emmett's covenant is an unauthorized covenant, and the people who have left the group should get their property back. So it suggests, one, that the communal idea of commonly held property was there as a background, but it was not part of the present church practice. And, of course, even in Missouri, it was not the practice to keep the property of people who left the church or left the community. They were able to take their property with them. So this went beyond what the church had practiced in Missouri. Just a word on punishments. I've mentioned some. Death penalty was talked about, but nobody, unless it was Herring, was executed. Excommunication was an option. Silencing was imposed on one man, the one who did Phelps's marriages. He was silenced, which meant that he couldn't exercise his priesthood authority for the time being. A number were flogged. Fines were very common. One man was essentially banished. He was told, we don't want to see you anymore, and he disappeared. Divorce was an option for them if they thought that it was called for. Compensation, public confession, a reprimand. Several times people were simply scolded and let go. Or even a deprivation of services that you can't cross on our ferry because you have not paid your debts in a particular way. Those were all that I mentioned, ones that were imposed by the court system, either the bishops or the council. There was also this informal vigilantism that went on by the police that I think was not formally authorized and yet I think has to be seen as important in keeping order, because some things are very hard to control by formal action, and a little bit of behind-the-scenes woodshedding is effective in dealing with some kinds of marginal misconduct. So finally, Winter Quarters gives us a little window on Mormon law. It is a situation where there was no separation of powers, where there were various sources of law, including some developed and inchoate notion of what the law of God would require if and when we became a theocratic society. They were not relying heavily on written law, on codes. They were relying more on the good sense of those who had to make decisions about people. The crime rate in Winter Quarters was low. The relationships among people were volatile. There was a lot of anger, I think, a lot of friction, but not very much that spilled over into the realm that we would think of as the criminal law. Let me just make one more final comment, really. LDS Church News today, page 4, 6, is an article about Pioneer Hero. Some of you will read this at home. It's about Deputy Sheriff Rodney Badger, who was also a counselor in the bishopric in Salt Lake City, who had given his life to save some immigrants who had tipped over their wagon in the Weber River. He saved a woman and 4 children. 2 other children drowned without his being able to save them, and he died in the process of trying to save these children who were drowned. Well, this is the same Rodney Badger who stole the horse from the Missourians. So that the mere fact that somebody at one time has done some discreditable things is not to distinguish them from us. If we haven't done something discreditable, you're very lucky, but that doesn't stop people from being heroic in the rest of their lives.
Thank you, Ed. I didn't mean to be so mean about the time. I just wanted to give Lee some time. Let me introduce Lee Worthen. Am I pronouncing that right? Lee just got his JD in 1984 from BYU's J. Reuben Clark Law School and is currently Associate Director and Head of Public Services for the Law Library at the University of Utah. And he told me he was going to make comments for about 5 to 10 minutes, and then any time we have left over, we'll have an opportunity to ask Ed and Lee some questions.
13 years ago, I was a student in Professor Kimball's evidence class at the BYU Law School. And when I received this assignment, I thought this would be a perfect opportunity to pay back for the grade I got in that class. But this paper is absolutely delightful, as I'm sure you'll agree. And it gives us some very good insights on an important time in the development of Mormonism and the Mormon community as a cohesive, an independent group, and it is a precursor or a forerunner of the type of thing that we come to see a little bit later as the wagons are crossing the plains and as the church settles in the Salt Lake Valley. And we see many of these same principles coming to apply, the requirements to build fences, the stray pen, the disputes over the stray pen, council, which was put into effect as the ruling body during at least the first year of settlement in the Salt Lake Valley. So we see lots of parallels here. And I have to say, too, that Professor Kimball did an excellent job of taking a 60-page, very well footnoted, very well written paper that he authored along with Kenneth Godfrey and cooked that down into a 45-minute presentation. I don't know how he did it.
Terrific.
Terrific job. I just want to make a couple of comments. And one that I thought that's important and I think was covered pretty well but might be elaborated on just a little bit, is that we see so much of what happens in at Winter Quarters and what goes on with the police and with the court and who is a very important source for this paper in the personality of Hosea Stout. And I think that I would like to see a little more elaboration of who Jose Estat is and what he does and what he later goes on to do. Although with time constraints, I realize that's difficult. But so much of who the police were is a sort of a reflection of who Jose Estat was. And we see Jose Estat in various roles. We see him coming as a pioneer. We see him regretfully being left behind from the pioneer group in 1847. We see him coming into the valley, and his very elaborate journals give us lots of insights on what's going on in the valley. And one thing that I had some experience was is to give a Sunstone paper a few years ago about the trial of Howard Egan in 1851, one of the first trials in the territory by a territorial court. And one of the best commentators, and particularly giving the legal point of view, is Jose Estat. He keeps coming up and up. But just one piece of insight that wasn't discussed here, that is discussed in the original paper, the 60-page paper, is a little bit about the altercation that arose between William Clayton, who seems like a fairly refined and non-threatening sort of individual, and Jose Estat. And Clayton was under fear for his life in early 1847 from Jose Estat because of some sort of incident that arose, probably because of Stout's perception of dereliction of duty on his part, that Clayton was afraid for his life. And they took him west with Brigham Young and the Pioneer Group on a half hour's notice to prepare. He had to get his stuff together, leave his family behind, and went across the plains as a protection against Jose Estat, the way I read it. A second thing that I want to comment about a little bit, and we read that in Clayton's journal. Another thing that I think is interesting is we see a lot of violence. But I wonder how much the violence and the threat of violence that was used in the enforcement of law was different from what was going on in other American communities of the time. And I think maybe it's not a whole lot different. And maybe because we don't have this sort of threat of caning or whatever, I think of the flogging incident or the caning incident of the young man in Singapore a couple of years ago. And we have this huge reaction from the public that, hey, maybe with all the crime and all the vandalism and so on that goes on today, maybe we ought to get back to the caning. So perhaps this was a pretty effective tool in prevention.
Third 5 months later, he says, "I haven't heard of any adultery since."
That's great. A third point is that maybe I'd like to see a little more about the interplay between winter quarters and the non-Mormon settlements, because we have Sarpy's trading post nearby, and we have Bellevue nearby with the French voyager who had settled there. And we do have quite a bit of interaction going on, trading even as far south as St. Louis and Missouri. And, you know, disputes arise. And maybe there isn't anything in the literature or in the documents that are available to indicate what that interplay was, and maybe there wasn't much. Fourth, I think that I mentioned a little bit about the continuation of the winter quarters system, and I'm wondering what happened after winter quarters. Did this system transfer over to Canesville when winter quarters was abandoned and the Saints moved back across the river? And I certainly see parallels to what happened with the groups who went on to the valley within the next year or two. And then I'm a little uncomfortable with the concept of common law. I'd almost rather call it natural law or customary law, because a system of perhaps even informal or unwritten law begins to develop with this society, with this Mormon society. And we see that coming to be called by the church something like Rocky Mountain common law, and we see that in the Egan trial coming up in 1851. But we also, at the same time in 1851, see a very formal rejection by the church of the concept of the English common law. And the English common law was never adopted in the territory until very, very late in the game. It's certainly not within the first 20 years the church rejects the idea of common law. So I think that's a term that we have to be very, very sensitive about using. I also puzzled about the law of God. I did a search on the info bases, the LDS Collector's Library, and came up with 360 references, many of them being in the Old Testament. And I think that this assessment of what the law of God is, this impending stricter law that Professor Kimball talks about, is exactly right. And it comes from an Old Testament concept of what the law of God should be, and it comes from the scripture in Isaiah that talks about the word of God coming forth from Jerusalem and the law coming forth from Zion. And they considered themselves, this new Mormon society, to be the impending Zion, and that the law would come forth from them. And they also make reference to, in many places, to the book of the law of God. And people's names are entered in that book of the law of God who have been obedient to these higher laws, such as adultery, avoiding adultery, tithing, consecration, and those types of things. Strict obedience to the church's idea of what's correct. And I'll end it there, but I think we need to give Professor Kimball compliments for doing a very excellent job of research and presentation here.
Well, I'm sure that I can speak for both of these gentlemen, and thank you for coming to the session today. We have about 2 minutes left. Does anyone have any questions? Unfortunately, I know. Anybody have any questions? Yes.
Haven't yet been able to get access to those. Yeah. We've requested permission to use the council minutes. Haven't yet got permission to do that. So it's Hosea Stout primarily, plus the journals of other people who were involved. I mean, if he says somebody was, there are several other people. Mary Richards, for example, has several anecdotes in hers and miscellaneous papers. But Stout, as was properly pointed out, is the main source, and you have to remember that some of his statements are probably self-serving, but I felt that I could rely on him when he's simply describing what the issue was before the court. Now, he never did anything wrong, as far as I can see, even when he himself said that he choked a man and would have killed him had he not been interfered with. He still thinks that he did the right thing. So you have to just discount a little bit his point of view, but on the external facts, I think he's quite reliable.
My question just related to that. Do you know anything about frequency of police abuse that has stepped beyond?
In winter quarters? I related a number of incidents, and I related every incident I know about. They were enough in comparison to the things they did legitimately to make it seem like an important minor theme, that it happened with some regularity, that they felt free to, if a kid was making too much noise, to tan his hide, so to speak. And even on at least two occasions, to make somebody believe they were going to be killed deliberately to frighten them.
So those are from Stout's journal?
Yes, those are from Stout's journal. Yes, and one of the things I said about the police loyalty, they'd have done anything Brigham told them to do. When he didn't tell them to do something, they went ahead and did what they thought was right, and then they reported to him. And at least Stout says that he approved, or the council approved, their conduct after the fact, saying, you know, you did just right.
I think we look at police conduct really through modern lenses.
What I'm saying is that we tend to put our modern-day values of what police conduct ought to be, and we'll look at some of these incidents as being abusive, and yet I have nothing to verify this, but my feeling is that if one were to do the research, they would find out that this was probably pretty typical police conduct anywhere in the country at that time.
I think you have only to compare, for example, the so-called third degree, which was very common half a century ago, with its near absence today, except on NYPD Blue.
You said that there wasn't a sect presidency, but isn't it true that the church did have a stake at Winter Quarters? I've seen in listings of the original stakes of the church that Winter Quarters was listed as a stake.
Not that I have ever run across. There was a high council, so in a sense you could say, well, maybe that equals a stake. There was also a high council across the river in Pottawatomie territory on the Iowa side. The thing was very different on the Iowa side, though, because they had these 80-odd settlements scattered all over. They didn't have a single place, so that the police didn't exist over there. The council over there, there are Pottawatomie council records that I haven't also got access to yet, but they will tell us about trials that occurred on the other side of the river. I think you'll find that it's somewhat different over there. The fact that you had this compact 4,000 people in an area that's about 3/4 of a mile long and less than half a mile wide, that's a very compact society.
But it also looks an awful lot like the high council that existed in the Salt Lake Valley beginning in the fall of 1847 after the pioneer groups began to arrive in the valley. And they had jurisdiction not only in religious affairs, but also apportioning land and deciding who was going to use the resources in the canyons and all sorts of civil types of things.
Right.
We'll wrap up. Thanks to both Lee and Ed and your attendance. And these tapes will be available, I think, in a couple of hours.